Lecture 20, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Hersham, October 27, 2006.
What do you have homework for? Due a week from Monday. First problem is looking at free electron theory. The basic point of this problem is that we saw for solids that free electron theory implies an outward pressure. This is the quantum pressure, and this quantum pressure will stabilize the solid from collapse. It will also stabilize many stars, in particular white dwarf stars, from collapse due to gravitational force. And so in this problem, you're going to explore that problem in detail. Basically, it allows you to rederive some things that we did in class in a completely different system to see how well you understand the derivation. And you'll derive something known as the Chandrasekhar limit, which will tell you the stability of these problems in astrophysics. Problem number two is exploiting the Sommerfeld expansion, which we've been doing in class, to calculate the electronic heat capacity to order T cubed. And problem three is considering free electron gas in two dimensions. You'll calculate some things such as density of states, Fermi energy, and the chemical potential, both using the Sommerfeld expansion and using the exact expression, and compare the two. You'll find that they're actually equivalent to one another to something like the 36th decimal place or something like that. So the Sommerfeld expansion does a pretty good job. Okay, so that's homework four. To do homework four, of course, we have to finish the Sommerfeld expansion, so that's what we'll do today. And probably have time to start on the theory of elastic vibrations in solids, also known as phonons. And where we left off last time is we had used the Sommerfeld expansion to write down some expressions for the energy density and the carrier density or particle density inside of a solid using free electron theory. So in particular, we made one assumption in the analysis. We assumed that the chemical potential differs from the Fermi energy by terms of order T squared. In addition, we exploited the Sommerfeld expansion . And I'm not going to go through all of that again. That's what we did last time. Where we got to last time were two equations. The first is that the energy density could be expressed as an integral from 0 to the Fermi energy times E times the density of states, dE, plus EF, the Fermi energy, times mu minus EF times G of EF, plus pi squared over 6 k sub b t quantity squared times the energy derivative of the density states evaluated at EF plus pi squared over 6 k t quantity squared times the density states evaluated at the Fermi energy. We also wrote down an equation for the particle density, n, which was an integral from 0 to EF of the density of states, plus mu minus EF times g evaluated at EF, plus pi squared over 6 kT quantity squared times the derivative of the density of states evaluated at EF. Is everybody comfortable with how we got here? Okay. And then, as I alluded to last time, we have to exploit physics to go farther. In particular, what we recognize is that this integral here, the integral over the density of states from 0 to EF, is simply the number of carriers, n, at 0 Kelvin. Furthermore, we recognize that since we are calculating the specific heat capacity at constant volume, then lowercase n, which is capital N over V, is independent of temperature, since the volume is constant. If we had assumed the volume was changing, like, for example, there was some expansion of the solid as a function of temperature, then we wouldn't be calculating C sub V, and obviously this wouldn't hold. But we are calculating C sub V, so this does hold. And as a result, the value of N at any temperature has to match that at T equals 0. And as a result, these two terms cancel. In other words, the remaining terms on the right-hand side have to be equal to 0. Therefore, we conclude that mu minus EF times density states evaluated at EF plus pi squared over 6 kT quantity squared derivative of G evaluated at EF has to equal 0. And as a result, we can now solve this equation for mu, the chemical potential. And when we execute the algebra, we'll find that mu is simply equal to EF minus pi squared over 6 kT quantity squared G prime evaluated at EF divided by G evaluated at EF. Now we know what the density states is evaluated at EF. We in fact did that calculation. So recall that G evaluated at EF is equal to 1 over 2 pi squared times 2m over h bar squared to the 3 halves times EF to the 1 half. Similarly, we can calculate the derivative dGdE evaluated at EF, which is of course just G prime EF, which is equal to 1 over 4 pi squared 2m over h bar squared to the 3 halves times EF to the negative 1 half. We plug these two equations into this equation and simplify, and as a result, we find that the chemical potential is equal to EF times 1 minus 1 third times pi kT over 2 EF quantity squared. So this is nice. We've now calculated the temperature dependence of the chemical potential. And what you'll notice is that the chemical potential differs from EF by a term of order T squared, which is exactly what we assumed. So our answer is self-consistent. So that's good news. Our analysis is therefore valid, at least to order T squared. The thing I'd like to point out is that at room temperature, kT over EF is approximately 1 over 100, or 0.01, in most metals. Which implies that mu differs from EF by approximately kT over EF quantity squared, that is 10 to the minus 4. 10 to the minus 4 is 0.01%, so it differs from EF by approximately 0.01%. So it's something in the fourth decimal place. It's a very small effect, if you will, and as a result, in solid state physics, and in particular in material science, where we're typically operating at or near room temperature, we can assume that mu is approximately equal to EF. And you'll often hear this used, especially in solid-state electronics textbooks, the term chemical potential often is not used. They'll just use the Fermi level or the Fermi energy in place of mu, because it differs by some small amount. And you'll hear me say this. I'll interchangeably use mu and EF when we're under conditions where they are effectively equal to one another. So we'll often use mu and EF interchangeably in material science. Okay. Especially when we're talking about the electronic properties of solids near room temperature. Okay, if everybody's okay with this analysis, what I want to remind you of is that since we just showed that mu minus EF times G of EF plus pi squared over 6 kT squared times G prime of EF is equal to 0, and we look back to our equation for U, you'll notice that the second term in this equation is proportional to this term, or this sum, and as a result, the second term in that equation goes to 0. So since this is true, we can see that U is simply equal to the first term, which is the integral from 0 to EF of E G of E dE, plus the final term, which is pi squared over 6 kT quantity squared times G evaluated at EF. Remember, what we're after is not U itself, but the specific heat capacity. And as a result, what we're after is C sub V, which is partial of U with respect to T at constant V. This term here, of course, is independent of temperature. It's just the number of carriers at T equals 0. And as a result, the only term which is temperature dependent is this term. We have to take the derivative of T squared, which is just 2T. And as a result, C sub V is just equal to pi squared over 3 K sub B squared T times G evaluated at EF. This is commonly written in the following form, where we recognize, as we derived last time, that G evaluated at EF can be written as 3N over 2EF. Since that is true, we can plug it into this equation and see that C sub V is equal to pi squared over 2 KBT over EF times N K sub B. Okay, so it took us a full lecture to get there, but we made it. We finally calculated a property, in particular, a thermal property of a solid, assuming free electron theory. So, like any good engineer, we'll then take our theory and compare it to experiment. And we recognize, however, in a metal, at high temperatures, C sub V approaches 3 times N K sub B. Which, since K sub B T over EF is approximately 1 over 100, 3N times K sub B is approximately 100 greater than the free electron result. So this is disappointing. We spent a whole lecture deriving this equation. We're only within a factor of 100. Okay. So it tells you life is more complicated than the free electron theory. Maybe that is what we should have expected all along. Furthermore, at intermediate temperatures, experimentally, experimentally, it's known that C sub V is some constant gamma times T plus some other constant A times T cubed. So this is at least somewhat encouraging, because we see that the first term in this is proportional to T. So this term here would result from free electron theory. So free electron theory is valid in some limiting case. In particular, as temperature approaches zero, this term will dominate over T cubed. But for any finite temperature, T cubed will begin to dominate, and then finally, in the limit of high temperatures, it will become a constant. So we have to explain this T cubed dependence and the fact that at high temperatures it becomes constant. These are the two things which we want to now explain. And this, of course, suggests strongly that free electron theory is incomplete. And, you know, I don't think it's that surprising. Presumably, the atoms, the nuclei, play some role in the properties of solids, right? Otherwise, all metals would be exactly the same. And we know that's not the case. There are differences among them. And so that's what we're going to try to explain in the next week, is why we have this T cubed dependence at intermediate temperatures and why we see it asymptote and approach some constant value in the limit of high temperature. And what we're going to do is consider the theory of elastic waves in a crystal, which we'll later call phonons. So before we move on, any final questions on free electron theory? As I suggested in the homework, free electron theory is quite generally applicable. It applies to solids, which are quantum mechanical entities. It applies to stars, which are obviously very macroscopic entities. So it's quite useful and definitely plays a role. We saw that it contributes significantly to the compressibility of solids, so we can't forget it all. It's just incomplete. There's more which we have to add to the picture. And so that is where we're going. In particular, let's consider elastic vibrations of a crystal. And we'll do the simple to begin with. We'll assume that this crystal has only one atom in the primitive cell. Okay. We'll consider this first, and then we'll move on to crystals which have more than one atom per primitive cell. In particular, we'll see as soon as we go to two atoms per primitive cell, for example, if you're looking at a sodium chloride crystal structure or diamond crystal structure, we have two atoms per primitive cell, that we'll find there's another elastic vibrational mode which is allowed. When we have one atom per primitive cell, there's only one elastic vibrational mode allowed. We'll describe that today. Okay. Before we do this, let me try to give you some context or describe what I mean by elastic vibrations. By identifying two different varieties of elastic vibrations. So these elastic vibrations come in two varieties. The first variety, which does not exist for traveling electromagnetic waves, is the longitudinal mode. By this, I mean that the displacement of the atoms in the lattice is parallel to the propagation direction. So elastic waves are going to be traveling waves. They're going to move through the solid. They'll move in a particular direction. And the atoms are going to be vibrating in place, and that's going to be how the wave is propagated by these vibrations of the atoms. And so you can imagine that the atoms are vibrating like this, and the wave is traveling in this direction. That is what I mean by a longitudinal mode. The atoms are vibrating in the same direction as the wave is propagating. This is not the case for traveling electromagnetic radiation. In that case, well, all you have are transverse modes. And you can probably guess that instead of being parallel, the displacement of the atoms is perpendicular to the propagation direction. Okay. So if this was a longitudinal mode, then the transverse mode would be like this, right? Or like this. Either of these would be transverse modes. And so in three dimensions, there's going to be two transverse modes, one longitudinal mode. There's 3 degrees of freedom in three dimensions. Obviously, if you want to reduce dimensionality system, a 2D system, then you can only have one transverse mode and one longitudinal mode. And in a one-dimensional system, you can only have longitudinal modes. Okay? So, for the longitudinal modes, there's one possible polarization, whereas for the transverse modes, we'll have two possible polarizations. Assuming we're in three dimensions, obviously in reduced dimensionality systems, then you'd have reduced polarizations. So let's just make sure we're on the same page by taking a look at some graphical depictions of these elastic vibrations. So this figure is out of Cattell. Figure one, in case you're interested, is just looking at many elementary excitations in solids. And eventually, if you take all the way through 451, we'll cover all of these excitations. Photons, we've kind of talked about. We'll talk more about them later. Phonons, elastic waves, is what we're talking about now. Plasmons, we'll talk about in 451. They're collective excitations of the conduction electrons in metals. Magnons, which is a spin wave, if you will, we'll cover in 451. Polarons, which is a combination of electronic and elastic deformation, we'll cover in 451. And excitons, we'll cover briefly. It's a bound electron hole pair. What we're talking about today, and what we've talked about thus far, are only electrons. Now we're going to add phonons to the mix. Figures 2 and 3 are now describing, or trying to graphically depict, these two phonons. Figure 2, the dashed lines represent where the atoms would exist in equilibrium. So we're looking at a cross-section. So these would represent planes going into the board, if you will. And you can see that the atoms are displaced in the same dimension as they're propagating. This vector k represents the propagation direction. So you can see the atoms are displaced from the equilibrium positions in the same direction as the propagation direction, as I was describing. On the other hand, this is one possible transverse wave where you can see that the atoms are being displaced in, say, the y direction, but the propagation direction is the x direction. And so that would be this case here. And you could have the third case like this. Okay? So I'll probably beat this over your head a little too much. Everybody okay with phonons? Okay. So we're going to try to describe, now quantitatively, first is, what is the dispersion relation for a phonon? That is, what is the relationship between omega and k? Remember, what we're always attempting to do is relate things back to the free particle solution, to the Schrodinger equation. And there we found that the dispersion relation was that omega was related to k squared, proportional to k squared. And the question is, for phonons, is that the case? Or is it linear in k or something more complicated, sinusoidal in k? So we first have to establish the dispersion relation. Once we have that, then we can calculate many properties that will result. So that's where we're going, to calculate the dispersion relation for an elastic wave in a solid, or a phonon. And to do this, we have to make some assumptions. first thing we will assume is that entire planes of atoms move in phase. And that was the picture I just showed you. It's a reasonable approximation. And what this does is it reduces a three-dimensional problem to a 1D problem. So that's definitely desirable from a pedagogical perspective, because we can do 1D much more easily than 3D. Second, we assume that the elastic response follows Hooke's law. Remember, Hooke's law is the law of a spring. So assuming the atoms are held together by springs, if you will. We know that a bonding diagram, any bonding diagram, is going to have some shape which looks at its minimum like a parabola. And that's, of course, the harmonic oscillator potential, which describes Hooke's law. That is the motion of a spring. So this is a reasonable approximation. Of course, if you were to look more carefully, there may be some higher terms, so-called anharmonic terms. Things just go as the cube or the fourth power of x in terms of energy. And those will lead to other phenomena in solids. And if we have time, we'll cover some of those. If not, we'll save it for 451. But first, let's assume an elastic response, which is simply means that the force, or we're assuming Hooke's law for the elastic response, which implies that the force is proportional to displacement. F equals kx. So there'll be some force constant we're going to have to invoke. What this further implies is that the quantum theory, so the theory we're developing today is not the quantum theory. We'll do that next. But the quantum theory of elastic waves i.e. phonons, we'll have solutions analogous to the harmonic oscillator. And that's why we bothered with that solution before, because it's directly relevant to the quantum theory of phonons. Under these assumptions, we'll be able to now derive the dispersion relation, omega versus k. And we'll find when there's only one atom per primitive cell, there'll be one dispersion relation, if you will, one band. Whereas when we add a second atom to the primitive cell, then there'll be two bands. And so we'll probably do that next week. Today, hopefully, we'll get through the first band. Okay. We need to develop some mathematical construct to deal with this problem. So what we're going to do is label the atomic planes as a series of integers, and s minus 2, s minus 1. This could go to s minus 3, s minus 4, etc. All the way up to s, the atomic plane we're looking at. And then there'll be planes going to the right of that, s plus 1, s plus 2, etc. So there's a bunch of planes which are labeled by s, s plus 1, or s, s minus 1. And they're each going to have corresponding displacements which would be u of s minus 2, u of s minus 1, u sub s plus 1, u sub s plus 2, etc. This is the exact nomenclature you just saw in the figure I put up on the overhead. Okay. We have to make more assumptions. We further assume that nearest neighbor interactions dominate. And as a result, if we're looking at plane S, then it's just the interactions with S plus 1 and S minus 1 that matter. Again, that's reasonable. We would expect those to be the largest interactions. So in a first order theory, that's where we would begin. And as a result, F sub S, which is the force on plane S, will be equal to some force constant times the relative displacement between S plus 1 and S. So the relative displacement would be U sub S plus 1 minus U sub S. Plus C, we're assuming the force constant is the same everywhere. U of S minus 1 minus U sub S. So that's the displacement between S and S minus 1. Okay, so we've just written down the Hooke's law for this problem under these assumptions. So this represents the relative displacement between adjacent planes. Obviously, that would also fall in that category. And C is the force constant or spring constant for this Hooke's law approximation. Now, I've been suggesting and walking around suggesting that there's a traveling wave. These last waves are traveling through the solid. And as a result, we're going to seek solutions of the form of traveling waves, that is U sub S will be equal to some displacement amplitude U times E to the IS KA times E to the negative I omega T, where A is the spacing between the planes. Okay, so this is exactly what we introduced before when we were doing free particle theory. We had a traveling wave which wanted something like e to the ikx minus I omega t. Okay. The nice thing about this is that if we want to look at u of s plus 1, then this s becomes s plus 1, or s minus 1, this becomes s minus 1. So this describes all the terms in our equation. The other thing I want to remind you of is that, of course, Newton's laws apply, and the force is mass times acceleration. And so F sub S will also be equal to m, the mass, times the second derivative of u with respect to time. Right, the second time derivative of displacement is acceleration, where this is the atomic mass. So what we're going to do is plug in the form of the solution we think we should find, that is a traveling wave, into this equation and manipulate it. First thing you'll recognize is that when we take the second time derivative of this, we're going to get out a term of negative omega squared times u sub s. Okay. So let's go ahead and plug it into the equation. So solutions of this form plugged in this equation will give us negative omega squared times m times u e to the I ska e to the negative I omega t. This negative omega squared comes from the second time derivative of this term here. This will be equal to c times u. U will be common in all of these terms, as will the constant c, so we'll pull it out in front, times s plus 1, which we know has a dependence of e to the I S plus 1 KA, as defined here, plus S minus 1, which is e to the I S minus 1 KA, minus 2 e to the I S KA, because we get one factor here and second factor there, so that's a factor of 2, times e to the negative I omega t, which also is a term which exists for all four terms on the right-hand side of this equation. At this point, we'll notice that every single term on both sides of the equation have u. They have e to the I s k a and e to the negative I omega t, so we'll divide both sides by that term. And as a result, this implies that negative omega squared times m is equal to c times e to the I k a plus e to the minus I k a minus 2. But e to the I k a plus e to the minus I k a is just equal to 2 cosine ka by Euler's formula. And as a result, we see that omega squared is simply equal to 2c over capital M times 1 minus cosine ka. We then exploit the trigonometric identity that 2 sine squared x over 2 is equal to 1 minus cosine x. And so if we let x equal ka, then we can see that this term here is just 2 sine squared ka over 2. And as a result, omega squared will be 4 times c over m times sine squared ka over 2. We can now take the square root of both sides of this equation and see that omega is equal to the square root of 4c over m times the absolute value of sine ka over 2, where we know that only the positive roots are valid here because omega is a positive real number. It's a frequency. So we've done it. We've derived the dispersion relation for a phonon, assuming one atom per primitive cell. And what we'll do is now plot it. There's a few things that are strange here. Remember before, for a free particle, omega when is k squared. And so the dispersion relation was just quadratic. Whereas here we see the dispersion relation is sinusoidal, which implies that it's periodic. So we have a periodic dispersion relation. And of course that implies that if we were at a value of k, or we went out by another period, that we'd come up with the same value of omega. So we have this periodicity. Let's plot the periodicity. So we're plotting omega versus k. We can see that the critical points occur for k equal to pi over a, 2 pi over a, 3 pi over a, or negative pi over a, negative 2 pi over a, etc. At those points, we'll know that the sine function is going to be maximized. For pi over a, the odd values, and will be 0 for the even values, that is pi, 2 pi, etc. So the critical points in this diagram will be pi over a, 2 pi over a, 3 pi over a, 4 pi over a, etc. We can do the same thing on the negative side. Let's go ahead and plot it. We know that the amplitude of this sine function will have a value of square root 4c over m, and will look like this. Okay, where if I was a good artist, this would look perfectly periodic. Now, because it's periodic, there's no unique information outside of the first period. And so that first period, which would exist between negative pi over a and pi over a, is a famous term in solid state physics, known as the first Brillouin zone. And we can see that if we plot the dispersion relation in the first Brillouin zone, then we know what it is for all values of k. And so that'll be the typical shorthand notation which we'll utilize in solid state physics, is just to plot dispersion relations in the first Brillouin zone. We'll see that when we do this for a solid, when we introduce an infinitely periodic potential, again we'll see this periodicity occurring. Thus far, for example, a free particle, we don't have a periodic potential, and as a result we don't see periodicity in the dispersion relation. But for an elastic solid, where we have obviously periodicity in the lattice, we're going to see periodicity in the dispersion relation. Same will be true for electrons when we introduce the periodic potential. So let's make a couple of notes about this dispersion relation. The first note is that the dispersion relation is periodic in the reciprocal lattice right. K represents the wave vector, which is inversely proportional to the distance, so it's the so-called reciprocal lattice, which tells us that the first Brillouin zone contains all unique information about the dispersion relation, that is omega versus k. So that would be the shorthand notation. Another thing that you'll find is true in solid state physics is that there's always a lot of action at two points in this dispersion relation. One is for small values of k, that is near zero, and the other is at the Brillouin zone boundaries. So let's talk about that as well. In particular, let me remind you of one thing that we found from dispersion relations in free particle theory in the first half of the course, and that was the group velocity. You'll recall we did this Taylor series expansion to derive an expression for the group velocity, and that analysis yielded that the group velocity is just equal to d omega dk. So if we take the derivative of this, the dispersion relation, we'll get out square root ca squared over m times cosine ka over 2. So the derivative of sine is cosine. And as a result, if we plug in k equals pi over a, then we'll get cosine pi over 2. Cosine pi over 2 is 0. And as a result, v sub g, the group velocity, is equal to 0 at k equals pi over a. If you have no group velocity, what that implies is that the wave is standing. It's not a traveling wave. And we'll imply that we have standing waves at the zone boundary. Okay. So that's kind of unusual, worth pointing out. Third note is that other limit I was talking about, the limit of very small k. So if ka is much less than 1, that would imply that we can Taylor series expand cosine ka, which would give us a term of 0th order, which is 1, minus 1/2 ka squared. Of course, there's higher order terms, but let's just take the ka squared term, plug it back into our expression for omega squared. In particular, we'll use the first expression there, which is omega squared is 2c over m times 1 minus cosine ka. So 1 minus cosine a, ka will just be 1/2 ka squared. And as a result, omega squared is just equal to 2c over m times 1/2 ka quantity squared, which is equal to c over m k squared times a squared. We take the square root of both sides of this equation and recognize that in the limit of small k, omega is equal to c a squared over m times k. And this is significant because we see that the dispersion relation in the limit of small k is linear. Okay. So we see that phonons behave very differently than free particles. Free particles, or say electrons, in the limit of small k had a quadratic dispersion relation, whereas phonons have a linear dispersion relation. As you may recall from introductory modern physics, photons also have a linear dispersion relation. For a photon, omega is equal to c, the speed of light, times k. Whereas the continuum theory of elastic waves, you find that omega is equal to the speed of sound, the sound velocity, times k. And so what it suggests is that phonons, or elastic waves in solids, in the limit of small k, behave a lot like photons, or more precisely, like you'd expect for continuum elastic waves, traveling at some velocity, and that velocity would be square root c, a squared over m. And is often referred to as the sound velocity, because it's analogous to the theory, the continuum theory of elastic waves. And of course, elastic waves propagating through the air travel at the speed of sound. So this is analogous to the continuum theory of elastic waves, where omega is proportional to k, and the proportionality constant is the sound velocity. So the theory of phonons is very similar to the theory of photons, and also similar to the theory of sound propagation. This, of course, because the dispersion relation is linear, is going to imply that there's going to be differences in the density of states. There'll be differences in the distribution functions. In particular, we're going to draw a close analogy to photons. Photons, we'll find shortly, are bosons. They'll use the Bose-Einstein distribution. And we'll derive the appropriate distribution function for photons, which will be the Planck distribution. From that, we'll then extend that analysis to phonons, which behave very similarly, except their velocity is different. They travel at the speed of sound as opposed to the speed of light. Another difference between phonons and photons, as I already mentioned, is that phonons have three possible polarizations, two transverse and one longitudinal, whereas photons only have two possible polarizations. So we'll get a factor of 3/2, which will pop up. And from that, we'll then be able to calculate what the specific heat is. Once we know this distribution function and the density of states, we'll do the exact same analysis we did last time, and we will find that in the limit of small temperature, an elastic wave will have a specific heat which goes as T cubed. That's giving us the T cubed term. And in the limit of high temperature, we'll asymptotically approach some value which will be equal to 3n times k sub b. And as a result, we will have resolved the two issues we had with the thermal properties of matter by adding phonons to the mix. That's what we'll do next week. Please remember that there's no class on Monday and Tuesday, so we'll meet you back here Wednesday. All right, thanks.
MSE 405.